Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann this hour. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's most recent data, more than 300,000 Americans died from an opioid overdose between 2000 and 2015. 300,000 people. That's twice the population of Dayton. Ohio is at the center of this crisis, leading the nation in both heroin and synthetic opioid-related deaths. But these tragic numbers do not reflect the consequences the opioid epidemic is having on children and families. The number of children put into foster care and child welfare agencies has risen sharply. The agencies must stretch slim resources to keep up. Today on All Sides, taking care of children left behind by the opioid crisis. Joining us now in the studio is the Assistant Director of Public Children's Services Association in Ohio, Scott Britton. Scott, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you for having me.
And by phone is the Director of the Tuscarawas County Job and Family Services, David Haverfield. David, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you. Thanks for letting me be part of this.
David, you wrote an op-ed column for the Columbus Dispatch detailing the challenges facing your agency and other agencies around the state. In particular, you told the story of one of your clients, a young girl left behind by her father who had just died of an overdose. The mom was not around, had not been around. The girl was now alone, and it was up to a fairly newly hired children's services worker to break the terrible news to this girl. How common is this story?
Fortunately, I should say unfortunately, it's becoming more and more common. A story that graphic really just struck me, where this young girl really just went from living at home with her dad, thinking everything was okay, to all of a sudden her whole world is turned upside down. So the epidemic, the opiate problem has caused is reaching everywhere, and I think these stories are probably more common. They just don't always get noticed.
And this girl had been in and out of foster care, you wrote.
Yeah, this young lady had been in and out of our system for a number of years. Her father had struggled with chemical dependency, with other issues, had seemingly got his life back together, was doing what he needed to do to take care of his child, and then, you know, it grabbed him back, and he was dead.
What happened to her now? What happened to her?
She's entered our foster care system. No one to take care of her. No family members, appropriate family members we can identify at this time. So we'll certainly look for them. But at this point, she's in a placement facility trying to deal with some pretty severe needs. Children that witness these kinds of things tend to have pretty significant behavioral needs, which really puts a strain on our system because those are difficult placements to find and they're very expensive also. So that kind of adds to the problem as well.
Scott Britton from the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio. What is the big picture across Ohio? How many additional children are entering the foster care system because of this crisis?
Well, Mike, David and his staff in Tuscarawas County are really on the front lines of this serious epidemic as it's unfolding. We did a survey of our members across the state at county children's services agencies and found that in calendar year 2015, half of the children taken into custody had parental drug use identified when they were removed. And overall, 28% of the children in our custody, that's 3,802 kids, have parents who use opiates, including heroin.
And it's not – has it hit its peak yet? I'm guessing it hasn't hit its peak yet. It's still rising.
That's really hard to forecast. I think from our perspective, we really appreciate the steps taken by the governor and the legislature to begin to address this epidemic. Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act has made an incredible difference for parents who before had not been eligible for addiction treatment services and now can access those. There have been changes to prescriber practices and the pill mills, obviously, to start with. But like you said, we really consider children to be the invisible victims of this epidemic, and we think it's time that the state address their needs.
David, you're in Tuscarawas County, a rural county, for those not familiar with Ohio geography, basically south of Canton, sort of eastern
Correct.
Ohio. What unique challenges do you face as a rural county with no major city to rely on in your county?
Well, certainly there's always the challenge of finding appropriate treatment for people to get into treatment. That, as Scott mentioned, has started to become addressed, so we're able to locate that. But, you know, the funding, of course, is a challenge for us. We don't have a child welfare levy here. Our county commissioners have been wonderful in helping us meet the needs of our kids, but we're kind of seeing a strange trend at least in our county. The numbers of kids in our care have gone down a little bit, but the costs have gone up considerably because these kids have such intensive needs. They stay in our system longer. Parents that are able to successfully overcome a heroin or opiate addiction take a very long time to do it. And so the children in our care longer, and it really has increased the costs and decreased our ability to find appropriate treatment.
Scott, are there enough foster homes, foster parents in Ohio to handle this increase in the demand?
Right now, I think we're concerned. We have agencies that are launching ambitious recruitment campaigns to try to find enough families. Obviously, our first goal is to place children with kin, as David was mentioning earlier. But when we have to place children in foster care, we have about 7,000 publicly licensed foster parents in Ohio right now to house about 14,000 children in care. So there is a private network of foster care providers as well. But we encourage anybody out there who's listening who has ever considered fostering a child to reach out and start the process.
So on average, these parents are fostering two children.
Probably on average. Some of them foster for a very long period of time. Others foster for very short periods of time. They take in sibling groups of four, five, six children sometimes. It varies quite a bit.
David, in Tuscarawas County, what is the situation there with foster homes and the available parents to help these kids?
Well, what we found is that, you know, we certainly find many of our children having to go to foster homes outside of our county, which really just increases makes the situation more complex. The children are further away from their biological family. We have a number of foster homes in our county, and we're able to recruit them pretty well. But the other end of that cycle is what we're seeing with the heroin epidemic is more than ever, we have kids that are just never going home. And our children go to permanent custody, our wonderful foster families adopt them, and then they're done fostering. So we're out, again, looking for, you know, new families to jump in and take part in our system. So those are just challenges that this opiate epidemic has really made worse.
David or Scott, either jump in. Is it you're having a harder time maintaining foster parents? Are families dropping out of the system because of the challenges they face, the new challenges they face with this opioid crisis?
I think that's not the biggest challenge. I think the biggest challenge is that we have children with such high needs that they're really not appropriate to put into foster homes. So we're putting them into treatment facilities. We're putting them into specialized programs to deal with very significant behavior. So that's really what we're experiencing in Tuscarawas County anyhow.
What kind of needs are we talking about here? Obviously, there's the trauma. I mean, I assume there's some post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety and things like that. What kind of needs do these children have?
It really runs a gamut. Certainly, we have children with post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, along with opiate addiction comes a whole host of other problems. We have children who have been sexually abused by not only a parent, hopefully not, but maybe just somebody that was in and out of the parent's home. So we have children with those issues to handle. Significant mental health problems. We have sometimes children who have very significant academic delays because they have not been getting consistent education, and even children with some medical problems because of a lack of consistent medical care. So really runs a gamut.
And Mike, I would add that we're also very concerned about the neonatal abstinence syndrome, the babies who are born addicted. And I don't know that we know yet sort of their trajectory and the long-term needs that they may have.
We're talking about the sort of hidden aspect of the opioid crisis in Ohio, and that is the children who are left behind by parents who have been overcome by this epidemic, or the folks who are struggling to get from within its grips. Here on All Sides with Ann Fisher, I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. If you have experience with this crisis, personal experience in the foster care system, a foster parent, a person who's gone through the system as a child, or someone who's giving care to these kids who are struggling to come around from after having a family affected by this crisis, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email your comment to allsides@wosu.org. Scott Britton from the Children's Services Association of Ohio, how does Ohio compare to other states? We know the epidemic is worse here than other states. How does the situation with regards to foster care, the funding for it, this demand you face, how does it compare to other states?
Well, listeners may be surprised to learn that Ohio tends to be last in the nation for the state share of child welfare funding. That means, for example, back in 13, of every dollar spent on child welfare, 52 cents of that was borne by counties, either through levies or through county commissioners. Federal funds came down at 39 cents on that dollar, and only 9 cents on the dollar comes from the state.
Why is that?
Well, Ohio has that history of home rule and county-administered social services, and I think there has long been an expectation that either voters will go to the polls and pass a local property tax levy, or the county commissioners will, as they do in Tuscarawas County, kick in the support for children's services agencies. And what we've seen is that creates a lot of inequity across county boundaries in terms of the kinds of services that can be offered.
David Haberfield, as director of the Tuscarawas County Job and Family Services, what has been the mood of the local populace there for funding more, passing a levy? Have you ever tried to go for a levy to fund children's services in Tuscarawas County?
We have not. We certainly are in the discussion stages of doing that. We try to be sensitive to the burden that taxpayers bear for a lot of different things, but it certainly is something that we've discussed. Again, we're very fortunate here that our county commissioners are very invested in making sure that our children are taken care of and that we're able to operate a system that we need to operate. But that's, certainly a challenge for particularly even much smaller counties where there really just aren't resources available. So we are discussing it. It's certainly something that's more on our radar than it has been for a long time.
And I would add that the cost burden continues to shift to the county level. Since 2009, we've seen the number of children in our care increase by 19%. We're up 2,000 kids from back then. At the same time, state funding has decreased by 17%.
Our state lawmakers, Scott, are they coming around to understanding the need that the state may have to chip into more of this because the system is in such a state?
Well, we certainly hope they are. I think we're fortunate that many of the legislators are former county commissioners and have had roles in terms of overseeing public children's services in their county, and recognize that many counties continue over and over again to go back to commissioners asking for more funds to cover these rising placement costs.
Are there counties that have a specific levy for children's services for foster care?
Right now, we have 47 of Ohio's 88 counties that have voter-approved children's services levies, or sometimes those are combined with aging services or health and human services. And that covers a little more than 80% of the child population in Ohio.
I should know this. I should at least look at my tax bill a little more closely. Is Franklin County one of those counties?
They sure are, yes.
Good. Okay. How about the surrounding counties in central Ohio?
I would say that Delaware County does not, but there are counties. County commissioners have been very supportive of children's services there, and Licking County is looking at an additional levy. They have a levy that supports them right now, and Fairfield County has a levy. I'd probably have to look to see what the status of the other surrounding counties is.
I hate to bring politics into this, David, but is there is there the political will to will voters see this and be willing to pay more taxes for this? Or are they, do they say, it doesn't affect me personally, I don't want to see my tax bill increase? Politically, how hard is it to put this on the ballot?
Well, I think it's always a challenge. It's always a question of timing as well. As we've seen, you know, from recent elections, their voters are in a different place now than they probably ever have been. So that's the challenge for us is, as we move forward and consider that is, you know, when to do it and to really gauge local interest. I think children in our system are something that people can relate to, but for most of our population, this just sort of exists outside of their world. They don't deal with this on a daily basis. They don't know that it's in their communities. They don't see it happening, but I think that's starting to change because, as you'll know from a lot of the national news coverage, the heroin epidemic is really hitting all socioeconomic classes. I mean, it's really impacting everybody from, you know, college-educated professionals all the way down to people in poverty who struggle with chemical dependency for a long time.
All right. David Haverfield, Director of Tuscarora County Job and Family Services, thanks for joining us here on All Sides. If you want to check out David's op-ed, it's if you just go to the Dispatch and search under his name or under foster care with the opiate crisis, you'll likely find it. It's worth your time. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
When we return, we'll look a little more closely at the process, the very difficult process of trying to help kids who are dealing with parents, caregivers who are addicted by opioids and heroin. When All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the children left behind by the opiate crisis, the children who are forced into foster care while their parents recover, or in the worst cases, after their parents have passed away because of an overdose. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the most recent data, 300,000 Americans have died from overdoses over the past 15 years or so. And joining us now are two folks who work closely with families and children who are dealing with this crisis. Elisha Cangelosi is the Associate Director of Provider Services for Franklin County Children's Services. Elisha, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Paula Davis is the East Region Associate Director for Franklin County Children's Services.
Thanks for having me.
Paula, let's talk about this process. You work with staff there that are having to remove children from parents and families that are addicted to these drugs. How do you find these kids, first of all?
Well, first, a referral has to come into our agency. So someone, anyone in the community would call, or a professional would call our intake hotline or come into our office and talk about what's going on with this family that they believe a child is being abused or neglected. And at that time, we have screening decision makers who look at the referral and they determine if it meets the Ohio Administrative Code guidelines to be screened in for us to have a response. So if it is screened in, then it goes to an intake investigation team. That team does a complete assessment. They do a safety assessment, a family assessment, really look at what's going on in the family. Does this meet guidelines that this should be an open case? And you may even find that a removal may even happen in that process, or it may not.
How long does that initial process take?
45 to 60 days.
Okay.
And then it's transferred to the ongoing division sometime in there. Sometimes if it's an emergent, like if there's a custody issue, it's transferred sooner rather than later. And then it comes to our ongoing division where I work, and we look at the long-term needs of the family. We develop a case plan based on the assessment that was done at intake. So it's really essential to have lots of good information coming in to inform us on here's what we need to do. We sit down with the family. We try to work closely with the family. We invite them in for meetings periodically through the life of the case to go over the case plan, to get their input, and to determine, based on what's happening with each individual situation, where we're going.
So referrals come from the courts, from neighbors, from family members.
Mm-hmm.
45 to 60 days, you want to be careful. You want you this is not something you do lightly or, mm-hmm. you know, off the, by the seat of your pants. But it seems like a long time, 45 to 60 days.
And that doesn't always take that long.
Okay.
Like I said, if you go out, you have mandates that you have to go out within, you have to make a contact within 24 hours. You have to actually make two attempts to go out to the home within 4 days. So you're immediately making contacts. And then we try to go out. We go out every 5 days after that to continue to assess, especially if you can't get in, to continue to make additional attempts to get in.
So if the situation is dire, the child could be helped with much sooner
than
60 days.
It's immediate reaction. But if you need more time to gather information, there's some more time in there.
How much effort is made to keep the child in the home with the parent?
We make every effort to keep children in the home if at all possible. We try to look at the supports the family has. We try to do least restrictive. If we do find that there is a need for the child, for the family to have additional supports, we look at first, if we find there is a safety threat, we look at first what's called a safety plan, where the family identifies people in their own family system that can move in with them or that they can go live with to help support them through this crisis.
So these are grandparents, mm-hmm. aunts and uncles.
Mm-hmm. Or even family friends.
Uh-huh.
So we look at that first. And if we don't have something like that, then we can look at, do we need custody? And we still continue to look at relatives even after taking custody. We always look at relatives first. At our agency, we actually, a couple years ago, we do no longer have a foster care parents through our Franklin County. We contract out for private agencies, mm-hmm. and we turned our foster care department into our kinship department. And so they help us find and locate the different kinship families, and they do our home studies, and then they provide ongoing support to those kinship families.
Of all the cases you see, how many of these children find a place in an extended family setting, a grandparent, a cousin, or aunt and uncle, and how many have to go to other – do you have any ballpark estimate of how many
– I do not have statistics with me today.
Kinship is a little difficult to gauge in Ohio because there are formal and informal structures.
Yep.
In some counties, the court requires that the agency retain custody of the child even when placed in kin. In other counties, that's not the case. But I should add that any decision to remove a child, unless it's a police-involved emergency, is always done under the jurisdiction of the county juvenile judge.
Okay. So the oversight to make sure that the law is being met, basically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But there are children who you never see that mm-hmm. go into that may just go live with a relative because the family makes the decision. Mm-hmm. That. How many of those kids are out there? Do we know?
I don't think we can necessarily, unless Scott has some information.
Well, I would say that our best estimate comes from the census. And at least a few years ago in 2012, we knew that about 100,000 grandparents were raising grandchildren in Ohio. I suspect that number has increased since then because it certainly increased over the previous 3 years.
We can assume that many of those are perhaps because of substance abuse, whether it be opioids or alcoholism or something like that, but we don't know exactly how many are because of that.
No, but my office gets calls regularly from grandparents who are telling tragic stories of having lost a child to an overdose, and they, on a fixed income, quite unexpectedly, are now taking grandchildren into the home and trying to find ways to support them.
We're talking about the folks who are left behind by the opiate crisis, the kids who are forced to live with relatives or moved into the foster care system. If you have a personal story about this, please give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Elisha Cangelosi from the Franklin County Children's Services. What is the emotional impact on the kids who have to go through this?
So I don't think I can say enough about what the emotional impact is on these children that are affected by the opioid epidemic, as well as just trauma in general that is occurring across our state, across our country. Trauma is a multi-layered, multi-impactful thing that happens to people, and it requires treatment in a lot of situations and a swift response oftentimes to make sure that some of those symptoms and behaviors that Scott talked about earlier can be mitigated as much as possible and help that child and help that family eventually move on towards some positive outcomes.
Schools, education has to – that's the center of a child's universe usually, the family and then school. How do you handle education and keeping the kids in school and keeping them on track?
We you know, depending on where they're placed, we are looking at, you know, what school they're going to. There's been a new legislation that is allowing kids to stay in their home school. Right now, that was just brought into law in December, and we're working on how our agency is going to how that's going to impact our agency. But now there's legislation out there that says that they can stay in their home district, even if they're living in another district. So we're looking at that.
But transportation becomes an issue there. And
yes, there's all kinds of different issues that we're starting to.
But that has to, at least if we can keep the kids in the same school, mm-hmm. that helps with the whole stability
yes.
thing. I mean, it's just
it
even for regular kids, having to change schools is traumatic. And then
right.
you're having to deal with all this. It's got to be.
Right. Well, when you look at a child, and just a child being removed in general from their home, you think about all the loss that comes with that. I mean, they've already had whatever traumatic event has happened, and then now they're losing their school, their home, their toys, everything that they know. Mm-hmm. So the more you can do to keep a familiar surrounding, the better it will be.
I think one thing I would also add to what Paula said, and then Scott brought it up earlier, that we are in a situation where when a child does have to be removed from a home, that we are always trying to look at kin first.
Mm-hmm.
But if that's not possible, then we're looking at paid placement options. And we're always trying to find the best match for that child. That's always our first we call it first match, best match. So,
what types of things go into that formula for a best match? What things are you looking for in a family? And how compatible that family would be for a child?
So we're definitely we obtain information in our placement unit from the service team that's been working with that child, as well as any assessments that have been done on that child, any documents that we have, any history that we're able to gather. Because what we're trying to do is look at the family that's been presented to us, like you said, and then also the behaviors and the needs of that child to make sure that they're a good match together. So it could be what is the home community of that child that goes into that placement decision. A lot of times, if we can keep them in their community, that's great. But as Scott said earlier, I would be misleading folks if I didn't say that we are in a position a lot of times where there is a shortage of placement options and families that are able to take these children. And so sometimes we're trying to get, you know, as many of those things lined up as we can, but it does present challenges both for the PCSA, the Public Child Serving Agency, as well as for the foster parents that end up taking these children and the networks that support them.
And there has to be sort of logistical concern. You can't have an older foster parent caring for an infant. Do you look at that? I mean, the age range of the parent versus the age range of the child, the teenager versus an infant, those are all the things that go get into a formula?
Well, as someone who's been through the training, I can say that all of the foster caregivers who are being trained indicate what types of children they are comfortable fostering. And so whether it's young, middle-aged, you know, older kids, kids with severe disabilities or not, they have sort of the first preference and indicate what they think they are capable of managing. And then when they get into situations, for example, with babies who have neonatal abstinence syndrome, we are very fortunate to have an amazing training program that can put coaches in that home to give parents sort of hands-on tips for how to comfort that child, how to help that child continue in the recovery from addiction that infant is experiencing.
We're talking about the effects of the opioid crisis on the foster care system, the children's services system in Ohio. Of course, there are many, many children that are left behind or have to be cared for while their caregivers, while their parents are recovering from opioid addiction or have passed away because of opiate overdoses. Our guest, Scott Britton, Assistant Director at the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, also Paula Davis and Elisha Cangelosi from the Franklin County Children's Services. Paula, has the thinking changed since the start of this opioid crisis, where you were perhaps more patient with a family with someone addicted to opiates, that trying to keep the kids in the home, and has that patience, as you've seen the effects of these opioids and the hold they have on folks, you're now less patient in getting the children to a safer place?
I mean, I think every situation is different. And so when you go in, you have to assess each individual dynamic that's going on. So it really just depends. As far as patients, I mean, I think we have to ensure safety. So whatever that looks like, we have assessments that help us determine, is this a safe environment? There are 16 factors that you look at. So I don't know if it's about patients, but it's more about assessment, really going in and really looking at what's going on to make sure you have a firm understanding of what the problem is. And then depending on the environment, how safe is that child? Are there needles laying around? What's going on in that situation? And then reacting. And then once a child comes into custody, we don't have the luxury of being patient because we're on a timeline. We can only have custody 12 out of 22 months before we have to file for a permanent plan for that child, which doesn't align very well a lot of times with the recovery process.
Yeah.
So we are really strongly encouraging parents to get into treatment and to solve this problem so their children can come home before we before we are mandated to do something different.
And the number of folks heading into permanent placement is increasing because of this crisis. Right, Scott?
We anticipate that when the data come out, we'll have more children awaiting adoption this year than before. And, you know, to kind of speak to some of the what our caseworkers are seeing and some of the challenges they're facing in addition to this opiate crisis, we're also hearing of some counties that are having more adoptions than reunifications now, which had never happened before because our goal is always to reunify, to stabilize the family, reunify the child. Now we're seeing more of these kids come into permanent custody and having to be adopted. And that's tough on our caseworkers' morale.
How common is it for a parent who has been suffering from opioid addiction to get clean, to overcome their addiction and to permanently take the children back? How often do we see these success stories?
I don't know if I can give you a number, but I see people who do it. They find what works for them and they stick to that plan. We have a family drug court in Franklin County. It's a very effective program. They get the families, the parents in, and they're meeting with them weekly at first, and then it kind of tapers off, but it's a very intensive program. And if people stick with that and stick with their programs, they're making it. There are families, there are people that make it. We see reunifications every day.
You know, and I'm grateful that Ohio's taken a very bold stance in support of medication-assisted treatment. We know from the research that this is not a drug that people can simply abstain from using and be successful in their recovery. And so using methadone or Suboxone or some of those other controlled substances to help in their recovery, I think, has been critical. We've had some really amazing stories of parents who have overcome their addiction. They've been reunified with their families. They've become recovery coaches themselves to help other families in the system. And yet I heard a statistic the other day at a conference that even after 15 years of sobriety, 1 in 4 heroin addicts will relapse.
That's incredible.
It's such a strong addiction. And I don't think those of us who don't deal with addictions personally can even imagine what that craving, what that is like.
Scott, I think you're exactly right. I think it's understanding that every situation is unique and that addiction is a lifelong journey. And also to remember that though we've talked about our children having trauma, what the research is showing us is that the parents of our children have also experienced similar trauma. So in child welfare, we're dealing with a multi-generational family system that has experienced similar things. And that has an impact. That has an impact on addiction. It has an impact on functioning. You know, poverty impacts that. It's really a system issue with lots of different factors.
Children has to be a motivator for an addict to try to get clean. When you lose your child, that I would assume is as bad as this addiction is. It's a motivator, an extra motivator to come clean and to get the help you need.
I think it can be for some families. I've also read that opioids can actually interfere with that parent-child bond. And so, I mean, we've heard stories from our county agencies where parents have been revived from overdosing with Narcan. And on the same night, they're leaving their children behind to go back for that next fix. It's just a kind of astonishing addiction.
All right. When we come back, we'll talk more about this situation, the kids who are left behind by the opioid addiction. We'll look at the other folks affected by this, and that is the caseworkers themselves. They have to deal with this on a daily basis, and that can lead to burnout and other issues. That's when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. This hour, we're discussing the impact of the heroin and opioid crisis on families and the agencies tasked with intervening when the children are in danger. Still with us, Scott Britton, Assistant Director of Public Children's Services Association of Ohio, Elisha Cangelosi, Associate Director of Provider Services at the Franklin County Children's Services, and Paula Davis. She's the East Region Associate Director for Franklin County Children's Services. We were just talking while we're off the air. None of us personally lived through the crack and cocaine epidemic of the 80s and 90s, at least as caseworkers. How does this compare from what you've heard, what when you've talked to folks who did have to deal with families in during that era? How does the opioid epidemic compare with the crack cocaine drug problem of the 80s and 90s and even into the early 2000s? Paula?
Well, I think one of the things we were talking about is there's just a whole – it's a different assessment process. The laws have changed. How we assess families is very different from that time to now. The screening guidelines have changed, so even what is considered a referral in the state of Ohio is different than what it was then.
Is it tougher now than it was then?
Yes.
How so?
I think it's more stringent. Like, for example, dirty houses. You might get a referral for a caseworker concern. Things like that have changed. The type of cases that we're getting today are much more egregious than whatever came in before. Something that might have been screened in then is not being screened in now. We're looking at things much differently. I feel like there's much more, just even since I started in 1989, the cases have become more complex.
So what does that lead to? Does that lead to fewer children being removed from homes, more children being removed from homes?
Actually, I happen to have a few numbers. It looks like in Franklin County, we do have less children today in paid care than we did at that time. Uh-huh. So we have, I think what it is we're doing a better job of assessing what's going on. We're really trying to look at who really needs an intervention.
So you know this house is really a problem. Mm-hmm. We need to intervene here. But another house, we could work with the parents a little bit.
Yes,
longer.
Or you can send them to a community resource, and that resource may be able to work with them without even us being involved.
Yeah, Mike, I would add that, in the 2000s, Ohio led the nation in reducing the number of children in care by 42%, as a matter of fact. So we got that number down to, on any given day, we had about 12,000 kids in care. But then we hit the Great Recession. We hit the opioid epidemic. Now we're up to about 14,000 kids, as I mentioned earlier, on any given day. And the cases that our caseworkers are seeing now, what they tell us is that they are much more complex. They require a lot more management, and that's reflected certainly in the evidence-based practices for this opioid epidemic. It requires more intensive case management services, greater collaboration within the county with your addiction services providers, with your courts, and that's what it's going to take in Ohio too to bring caseloads down to so that caseworkers can really work with these families on reunifying children.
Right. We're talking about the opioid crisis and the effects on kids who are left behind or having to deal with caregivers and parents who are addicted to painkillers and heroin. Elisha Cangelosi from Franklin County Children's Services, the caseworkers who have to deal with this, we heard the story at the beginning of the show of this caseworker who had to tell a girl whose dad promised her he would never leave her that her dad was dead. That has to be – how does a caseworker prepare for that? How do they cope with that?
So our caseworkers go to school to do social work or to do counseling. But what I know – and Paula would agree with me. We were talking about this before we came in today, that no book, no schoolwork ever prepares you for what you're going to see as a child welfare caseworker, as a child welfare mm-hmm. supervisor, even our support staff that are reading the stories and typing up reports about the things that have happened to our kids and families. It is something that stays with people. They actually refer to it as secondary traumatic stress. So a trauma that you've experienced by hearing the story someone else has told you or them recounting that event, sometimes it is direct exposure to things in a house at mm-hmm. a removal. That impacts people. And combined with the high caseloads yeah. and the types of cases that Paul and Scott just described, it really creates to it really creates a situation for our workforce in child welfare that can become problematic at times.
Yeah. In 2016, based on some data we've collected, about 1 in 4 caseworkers left the job.
Wow.
Meaning that the agency had to spend a lot of time and resources to recruit, interview, train, replace, and get those folks up to speed so that they could carry a full caseload. And, you know, about 15% of the caseworkers left not for reasons of retirement or promotion or for disciplinary issues. They left because I suspect the job was just too hard.
I assume because of these – probably because of the visits, frequent visits, that it's not uncommon for a caseworker to see an overdose, a fatal overdose, or a traumatic experience when the kids are right there in the home.
That can happen. I know I came in one day last week and a caseworker had come in my office first thing in the morning, very distraught, and said that she just learned that a parent had died yesterday on the caseload and needed to know what to do. So we sat down and we talked through the situation and how she would go out and what she would do and what she would say and what support does she need to do this and then how she felt later. So, I mean, it's very traumatic for everyone.
Yeah. Our caseworkers are really first responders, like police and firefighters. They don't go out with a gun and a badge or a fire hose, but they go out and see families in crisis on a daily basis and within the law and the rules that are established make some very serious decisions.
And they're being called at all hours of the night, I assume, and weekends. This isn't just a 9-to-5 job where when overdose happens, the caseworker is called, whether it be 2 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon.
Right. Franklin County is a little lucky in that we have a second and a third shift, but they still will call the ongoing staff just to get their opinion if it's a situation that rises to that. But we are staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and there's a great need for that.
Elisha, how has the infrastructure at the Franklin County Children's Services changed to help caseworkers? Counseling services, has that changed since the opioid epidemic took off?
We have. We're having discussions now that we're having discussions in different ways. Let me say it that way. Things like a secondary traumatic stress work group that was formed, peer support groups that are available at the agency for our caseworkers to utilize when they're needing that extra support, in addition to their supervisor and maybe their associate director and director. So we are having those conversations, trying to put things in place to let caseworkers and staff know that we do see that they are experiencing the secondary trauma and that does have an impact on them. Continually trying to let them know that administrators are listening to that and that we know that it's real because there, you know, have been, I know in my early career, a lot of times there was that mantra, you know, you got to keep moving. You can't sit here and cry about a case. And, you know, we're still combating that mantra in a lot of ways because we do see so many terrible things on a daily basis. We also see a lot of really great things that happen, I'd like to say.
Yeah.
But it does take its toll.
We're talking about the opioid crisis, in particular how it affects children who are left behind by parents, caregivers addicted to heroin or synthetic opioids here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Just a few minutes left. If you'd like to jump on, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Let's look forward. Scott, any signs that we've reached the worst at this point? Is there any that we've hit the peak and we're going to start to go down the other side and overcome this crisis?
I've heard so many different predictions about this epidemic. I think it's hard to really get a handle on where we're going and whether we've hit the peak. I think that some of the data I've seen suggests that we're starting to level off a little bit. It's an unpredictable addiction, and I think we need to do everything we can to really protect the next generation from finding their way into that addiction.
That's another impact 10, 15 years down the road. These kids who have gone through this, they're going to have kids. And if their parents have addictive tendencies, studies have shown that it can run in families. I mean, what's being done for these children, you know, 10 years after or 5 years after they've been taken out of the home or gone through foster care and maybe been reunified with the parent? Is there ongoing counseling services for these children?
I mean, there are ongoing services. After we close a case, it's up to the family to follow through on whatever is needed. If a child is adopted, there are services through. They can come back to our adoption department and talk about different services that are needed. So there's that ongoing support. But if we have closed and the child has gone home, it's really up to the family to continue to link them. I mean, we do try to link services through the life of the case to assess the needs of the children and to look at, you know, what is best. I know just our agency has done a lot with looking at trauma and how it impacts children. We work with our Family and Children First Council. We've brought in Dr. Bruce Perry through his neurosequential model, done a lot of training with that. The Building Better Lives initiatives in Franklin County are working with lots of different partners in the community to infuse his ideas into different settings like Columbus Public Schools, different agencies. He uses a lot on self-regulation, different things to help people deal with trauma, to help all of us deal with how do we regulate better. And all of that will impact well-being in the end.
Trying to break that cycle with this generation, hopefully, and not have to deal with this 10 years down the road. Elisha, what needs to be done to help the system, to help these kids get through this crisis?
I think the first step is really what we've started to see, which is a real recognition that this is happening and it's real and it's here and it's not going to go away without some intervention, without appropriate resources, funding, services that are needed to help kids and families. So I think it's really buckling down, which I think a lot of us have done and continue to do, and knowing that trauma is out there, it's happening in these situations, but treatment can also work. You know, services can also have an impact and can really change the course of a family's life, like you said, not just for the child and family unit that we're working with right now, but for their children and their children's children down the road.
Scott, with all the different facets of this crisis, whether it's the enforcement trying to stop the drugs from getting onto the street, to the getting the folks into treatment and the ongoing treatment, and now helping the kids left behind, is there enough money to help all of these different parts of this problem?
Well, I can't necessarily speak to the other sectors, but I don't think Ohio should be last in the nation in its investment in child welfare. I think our state deserves better. Our children and families deserve better. And it's we need that larger investment because the caseworkers are managing these much more complex cases and they need to spend more time with the families and children.
Paula, we need more caseworkers. Is that what that would help? Where should this money be spent, I guess, is my question.
Well, staff would definitely assist with the issue. I know we are dealing with the turnover that the rest of the state is dealing with. We would love to be at the 12 caseload, which is recommended and ongoing. So more caseworkers. I think.
So 12 caseload is each caseworker has 12.
Not now. That's been a recommendation.
That's the ideal, or
yes,
the recommendation is 12. And how many cases do they have now?
My seasoned staff average about 18 right now.
Okay, so we're talking 50% more than what they should have.
Yes.
So if you're 18 cases at any one point, that's hard to do.
That would definitely help. And then, looking at services, what the evidence-based practice, what can really impact these families in the long run?
I would say that every county is a little bit different. Some need more caseworkers. Some need more foster caregivers. Some need funding for these expensive placement costs. Some of the rural counties just need more treatment service availability. So it runs the gamut. Some counties need all of that, unfortunately. But I think it varies because we've got very different counties and very different agencies across the state.
Would coordination help, having one-stop shopping for a family in crisis or a person in crisis this is where you can get help for your kids, get treatment? Do we have that now? Is that a way to efficiently use these dollars?
Well, that is the goal of the Family and Children First Councils. Uh-huh. And in Franklin County, for example, Family and Children First is the convener of all of the various social services providers that tries to look at needs and collaborate across those sectors to meet them.
All right. It's a problem that's going to be with us for a while longer. Hopefully we've reached the peak and on the backside of this crisis. But another factor is the kids left behind by the folks who are addicted to opioids and heroin. We'd like to thank our guests this hour, Elisha Cangelosi and Paula Davis from the Franklin County Children's Services, and Scott Britton from the Public Children's Services Association of Ohio. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann Fisher on All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.